So at the end of the last lecture, I was talking about the short-time Fourier transform and its limitations. And we went through a couple of these limitations, and I pointed out that wavelets would be a way of getting past these limitations. So we're going to start talking about wavelets today. Just to refresh your memory, the limitations of the short-time Fourier transform. Firstly, computational cost. It's not a very efficient algorithm. It takes quite a lot of computation to provide you with your short-time Fourier transform. The second, and in some sense more important limitation, is this fixed trade-off between time and frequency. So our goal here with the short-time Fourier transform was to see some of the frequency information and some of the time localization. And we run up against this barrier which says we can't make our rectangles or our little regions of time-frequency space any smaller in area. So we end up either having long thin ones or short flat ones or kind of square one, square box in this space. We can't squeeze more out of that. The short-time Fourier transform has the limitation that all of its rectangles are the same size, even though it would make sense to be able to partition the time-frequency space up, perhaps so that we had higher frequency resolution for low frequencies where we don't care about the time resolution so much, and the time resolution should be better for the high frequencies where things change a lot. So this is what wavelets are aimed at doing. But before we go into wavelets, I want to talk more about this cutting up of the time frequency space. And I want to really get to a sort of theoretical understanding of what I've been calling this uncertainty bound. At the moment, what we have is a very ad hoc argument that this is the case. So I want to really demonstrate to you theoretically that this is a property that we have to care about. So firstly, let me refresh your memory about one of the critical properties of the Fourier transform. So this is back from lecture two. So what we're talking about here is the Fourier transform of a function which has some sort of time scaling going on in it. So if we make alpha less than 1, that means we stretch out our function in time. If we make alpha, or we make a, sorry, greater than 1, that means we squeeze our function down in time. We sort of compress it. What this is saying, we can ignore for all useful purposes this 1 over a scale factor because we care about the magnitude of the Fourier transform, we care about the relative magnitude, not the absolute magnitude of it. So the scale factor is not the most important thing. We do have to keep track of it. So we will keep track of this. We will have these 1 over a's cropping up all over the place. It's not the important thing. The important thing is this factor here. Instead of multiplying by a here, we have a divide by a. So what happens when we squeeze in the time domain, we stretch out in the Fourier domain, and vice versa. When we stretch in the time domain, we squeeze down in the Fourier domain. This is really one of the things that's contributing to uncertainty. So I want to sort of give you a proof of this, and I also want to derive a few related things attached to it. But you have to be aware of this property. If you haven't seen this property or you don't remember this property, a lot of this lecture is not going to make much sense to you. So let's just keep this property in the back of our minds. In fact, if I can find a bring one with me. I can find a text where I'll write it up on the board. No, I haven't got one. These lecture theatres generally don't have markers. Oh well. We'll come back to it if we need it. Okay, so the uncertainty principle arose first in physics. And it's named after Heisenberg. He's the guy who really came up with this idea. And essentially it arose in the context of subatomic particles. So imagine you were interested in a particular subatomic particle, let's say a neutron. Neutrons are good because they're pretty simple. They're just this single neutral particle. And you'd like to know something about that particle. So you measure it. How do you measure the position of a neutron? Well, neutron has neutral charge, so you can't use some sort of electromagnetic inference. What you can do is bounce another particle off that. So if you just fire, say, an electron at that neutron, and that electron bounces off, then you'll have some idea where that neutron was. Okay, you can measure you know, you send your electron in with a precisely known velocity, bounces off the neutron, you measure where it bounces back to, that tells you something about, firstly, position, because you hit the neutron in the first place. It tells you something about position by the time it took for the electron to hit it and then come back. So you learn something about position. But unfortunately for us, particles have this dual particle wave nature. So an electron is not really a particle. Much as we would like it to be a particle, it's this quantum fluctuation. It's a quantum thing, quantum phenomena. So in some sense, we have to treat it like a wave. And one of the things we've been doing here is we've been studying things like sine waves. We've been studying waves. So this is how this relates to what we care about. But if you think about a wave, when you bounce a wave off of something, what do you learn about the position of that something? Well, you learn something about its position, but there's an inaccuracy in it. And that inaccuracy is of the order of the wavelength. I'm not going to try and prove this. I'm not giving you a physics lecture. I'll talk about frequency time stuff in a second. But what Heisenberg realized was, well, you know, you have this inaccuracy in your measurement. So the natural thing to do, simple, obvious thing to do, is choose an electron with a shorter wavelength, or a photon with a shorter wavelength, whatever particle you want to do. That will reduce your error. The problem is, as you reduce the wavelength of a particle, you do this by making it more energetic, by making it move faster, or by having a photon with more energy. What happens when you bounce something off something else? Well, you give it a little kick. You give it a change to its momentum. The more energy the thing you bounce against has, the bigger a kick you're going to give it. The problem here is, if you choose a very fine wavelength so that you get accurate localization in space, you have to have a high energy particle, and that high energy particle will then give a big kick to the neutron that we're interested in measuring. The net result is we lose information about the momentum of that particle. So the better our localization in position, the worse our localization in momentum is. So this is the relationship here. You get, this is your error in position, this is your error in momentum, and the product of these two is going to be greater than or equal to Planck's constant on 2 pi. Planck's constant is very tiny, so this error is very small unless you're dealing with subatomic particles, in which case it becomes significant. So how does Heisenberg's uncertainty principle apply to us? Well, in this form it doesn't directly, but notice that it does depend on this notion that you have a wave here. This is part of the notion that starts the reasoning towards Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So let's try and take this a little bit further. Let's deal with a wave. Let's deal with some sort of signal, in fact. Maybe not a wave, some sort of general signal. And we're going to look at a transient signal because it makes no sense for us to look at a signal that goes on forever because localization doesn't matter then. The only time localization matters, the only time working out where that signal is matters, is if that signal has some location. It's an infinite signal, it doesn't really matter. So we're going to look at transient signals. So the first thing we have to do is define what we mean by the location of a signal. So that's not too big a deal. Imagine you have some signal. What we're going to do is look for the mean location of the power of that signal. So this is the power, and this is the way of writing the mean. Remember, this is our standard notation for the norm of a function. So the standard L2 norm here, which would be the integral over the absolute value of f squared without this t in it. So this is really the mean location of our particle, or our function, our signal. So this is not quite the same as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, because there's some sort of notion in our minds with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that the neutron has a position. Okay, so one of the things quantum mechanics did was it threw out that as a naive idea, that the neutron no longer has this distinct position. It's some sort of wave function that describes the probability of it being in the position. And that's the sort of thing we're studying. We're studying a function. It's some sort of function. It has some localization. But it's not a delta. If it was a delta, that would be kind of trivial. Well, it could be a delta. We could have a delta in here, in fact. And we have localization. We have a notion of localization in frequency and a localization, localization in space and localization in frequency as well. So a delta is actually kind of an interesting case, because if we take a delta in space or in time, that's perfectly localized. It's an impulse at, you know, one spot. But in time, in the frequency domain, what does a delta give you if you take the Fourier transform or the power spectrum of it? And if we look at the power spectrum, we just get a constant. So the frequency content of a delta is spread over all of the frequencies. So these are the two things that we're interested in. It's the location in time and the location in frequency. Now, we also need some way of measuring the error in our location. So this is not an error in the sense that it's a inaccuracy. This is an uncertainty. This is, if we have our frequency here, but it's spread over a few seconds around there, you know, this mean, it doesn't tell us everything about the signal. We need to know somehow how spread it is in time or in frequency. So this we're going to do by looking at the variance. And this is just standard definition for the variance, again, variance in time, variance in frequency. And you notice that we look at the variance, it's the squared value around the mean or around the in time or in space. So these are our definitions of, you know, the location of a signal and its uncertainty, the variance around that location. You notice these are not, this is not a hard, fast thing. This doesn't say that the signal starts here and ends here. The signal itself could extend to infinity, but it has to decay away, to being zero, because we're interested in transient signals. Is this making sense to you all? Does anyone have any questions? This is kind of a subtle concept, so I'm happy to answer questions if you're not getting what I'm saying. Okay, so here's the uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle looks like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. We got rid of Planck's constant because that was kind of a physics thing, that's subatomic particles. We don't need Planck's constant here. We still have uncertainty in this case, uncertainty in time, uncertainty in frequency, and the product of the two is going to be greater than or equal to 1 on 4 pi. This is our uncertainty principle. And this is really one of the the kind of coolest things we come across in transform methods. This is really, there is a lot here. There is a lot of depth in this theorem. You could spend a long time, you could probably spend the rest of your life trying to understand this theorem. It's got some interesting subtleties to it. But we're not going to try and spend the rest of our lives on it. We're going to spend one lecture on it. So let me try and make a little bit of progress. Firstly, this uncertainty principle, this is a bound. It's natural to ask, do you ever achieve that bound? And if so, when? And the answer is, we can achieve that bound, and we do it for a function which looks like this. What is this function? Well, this function has the name, the Gabor function. That's the name people typically give it, after a guy called something or other. Professor Gabor is a good way of putting it. I don't know his first name. What is this function? Well, this part you should recognize. This is just a complex sinusoid. This is something we've been dealing with again and again and again in this course. So if you don't recognize this function by now, then I suggest you do a lot of work in the next couple of weeks so you can fail the exam. You really have to understand this. This A at the front is inconsequential, it's just a scale factor. This thing here, anyone want to give me a guess as to what function that is? What's that? It's a Gaussian. It's a Gaussian friend that we've come across again and again throughout this course as well. So you should really recognize this thing as a Gaussian function. It's centered around U. So it's not centered around zero. The Gaussian function centered around u, and you notice we have this extra factor in here. This is kind of a scale. If we make b a big number, then we get this sort of very fine spiky Gaussian. As b goes to infinity, we get something that looks more and more like a delta. As b goes to zero, you get something that looks flatter and flatter until as b, when b equals zero, what happens when b equals zero? You get e to the power of zero, which is a, it's a constant, it's just one. Okay? So when b goes to zero, you get something that's flat, that's constant. So this encompasses a wide range of functions. This is complex sinusoids with some sort of Gaussian over the top of them to make them look like they're a transient signal. And for this case, we can explicitly work out the variance in time, the variance in frequency, and we can look at these two guys and we can multiply them together, and we get, if we multiply them together, we get 1 on 16 pi squared, take the square root, and get 4 pi. So for this particular case, we achieve the bound. We have equality. But for no other case do you get equality. So let's do a little proof. Firstly, without loss of generality, I can consider the case where u and xi are equal to zero. That is, the time and frequency are both localized around zero. Why can I do this? Well, I can always multiply a function by, for instance, I could multiply it by this exponential. What does that do? Well, that, remember, by the modulation property, multiplying by a complex exponential shifts the frequency. So this thing, multiplying by this, just shifts the frequency. And you can see that happening here. Here, we multiply by this guy. This is just a change in frequency. Obviously, this is going to be localized around frequency xi, because this is just a shift in frequency. And if we had a pure Gaussian, it would be obviously localized around frequency zero. Okay. Likewise, I can just take a time shift, and that will shift the location of the signal in time. And the equivalent operation in the frequency domain is multiplying by a complex exponential in the frequency domain by the duality property of the Fourier transform. So again, we have these bunch of properties that you learn about in the second lecture, and we are using them here. So we don't have to worry about the general case with u and xi. We just take u and xi equals zero. That makes life a lot easier for us, particularly you go back to these definitions, and particularly these two definitions, and when u and xi are zero, these two definitions look a lot simpler. In fact, they look like these two things. So I have my sigma t squared, my sigma f squared, multiply them together, and I get a product of two integrals that looks like this. Okay? So this is not too complicated. One trick that I want to pull is, remember our differentiation property of the Fourier transform. The Fourier transform of a derivative is just I 2 pi s times the Fourier transform of little f. Okay, so where I have big F here, I can simply where I have s squared big F, s squared big F squared here, like this, the I 2 pi again, I really should have kept a factor of 2 pi here, 2 pi squared here. But the 2 pi we don't have to worry about again, it's just going to be a factor that's going to drop out. The I, when I take the absolute value of I squared, we just get 1, disappears. So we end up with s squared times the absolute value of s squared, which is this thing here. So I can replace this thing up here with f dash squared, integrated here over time rather than over frequency. So rather than getting two integrals, one of which is an integral over time and one of which is an integral over frequency, multiplying them together, I'm going to get two integrals over time, which looks something like this. You notice that I should have kept my 2 pi here. I've kept it here though. I didn't drop it out. I've got my 4 pi squared. I divided 3 by 4 pi squared to keep that factor in there. Okay. So now I have these two integrals that are being multiplied together. The trick I want to use is to use a thing called Schwarz's inequality. There are various forms of Schwarz's inequality. If I had two real functions, if f and f dash were both real functions, then the form of Schwarz's inequality that I could use looks like this. And you can see immediately what would follow from this inequality. I have an integral over something squared, another integral over something squared. I replace it by an integral over the two things, and then I square everything. So I replace these two integrals by one integral over t, f dash, f, which is in here, and then all squared. Okay, so this would be an easy, this would be easy. Life is not quite that easy because I want to be able to deal with functions that aren't real. Why do I want to do that? Well, I want to be able to multiply by my complex exponential so that I can shift frequencies. So I don't want to make it this simple. I want to allow complex numbers in here. If I have complex numbers, then the appropriate form of Schwarz's inequality looks like this. And this is out of Breithwell. So it's the same thing basically, but instead of ending up with a product of two things, I have these two products, one each of which, this is your, you know, your complex conjugate, this is your complex conjugate here. When I apply this to the integral that I'm interested in, I get a form like this. Now, the nice thing about this is it's simply, it's f dash times f. F dash times f is just the derivative of the product. This is really just the product rule here when we think about differentiation. So if I take the derivative of f, f star, then I'm going to get f dash times f star dash times f. This, again, repeat that. This is just the product rule for differentiation. So inside my integral here, I now have t times some derivative. I'm just going to use integration by parts. Integration by parts of this thing, I end up with, over here I get t times the absolute value of little f squared, and I'm going to evaluate that at infinity and minus infinity. And over here I simply get my integral from minus infinity of the absolute value of f squared. So this integration by parts is not a terrible trauma. However, remember we are interested in transient signals. The whole point of transient signals is they decay away to zero. And so I'm going to have a simple definition of transient. I'm going to use a definition that looks something like this. The square root of t times f has to go away to zero. If the square root of t times f goes to zero, then I can show that t times the absolute value of f squared is also going to go to zero, and therefore this term here drops out. Becomes zero because I'm evaluating this at infinity and minus infinity, or the limits thereof. So that term drops out. I'm left with this first term, or the second term, sorry, I should say. What's this thing? Well, this thing here is just my L2 norm squared. And remember, I've got a square out here, so I have a square squared, that's to the power of 4, that's going to exactly cancel with this norm to the power of 4 that I have on the bottom line, so I'm going to be left with 1 on 16 pi squared. Notice these guys are squared over here, so I take the square root and I get sigma t times sigma s is greater than or equal to 1 on 4 pi. So there you go, proof of my uncertainty principle. Schwarz's inequality comes with a caveat. The equality is only realized when one of my functions is a scalar product of the other function. So what does that mean in our context? Well, our two functions that we have in Schwarz's inequality here are tf and f dash. So that means that tf has to be a scalar multiple of f dashed, or vice versa. So f dash is minus 2b tf. I've just chosen b here. I know it's going to be b. So You just have to know that it's going to be a scalar multiple here and it follows through. I just chose the one I wanted to be. If this is the case, this is a simple differential equation. We know how to solve differential equations, I hope. We're going to get f is simply some scalar times e to the minus bt squared. And this is our function. This is the function for u and xi equals zero. This is the function where that inequality attains its bound, where you attain the equality. And you can see it's just a Gaussian function. Okay, so this is the case for u and xi both equal to zero. How do we change them? Well, we do a time shift to change u, and that's what's happened here. I've done a time shift. And we do a frequency shift here to change xi. The way we do a frequency shift is we multiply by that complex exponential. And that's how we derive this Gabor function being the function which localizes the best in time and space. Time and frequency, I should say. So here's my definition of a Gabor function. It's some function of a time t. It has four parameters, a, b, u, and xi. We can calculate its Fourier transform pretty easily. In fact, I think I set you a class exercise to calculate this Fourier transform earlier in the year. So you should have seen something along these lines in terms of calculating Fourier transforms. Obviously, I say obviously, it should be relatively obvious to you by now, you're going to get another Gabor function. Why is this obvious? Why is it obvious that the Fourier transform of a Gabor function should be a Gabor function? Because that's a good answer. The reason, I mean, because of this Gaussian, you could work it out and you could show it. So you could use that to show that you must get a Gabor function. The reason it's obvious, okay, this uncertainty principle, there's a duality in it. Shift time and frequency. Okay, so the uncertainty principle says that if I take my function in time, the way I achieve equality with this bound is by having a Gabor function. But there's duality. I could have proved the uncertainty principle in the frequency domain. I could have done all of my calculations in the frequency domain. And then I would have proved the frequency domain version that attains equality would be a Gabor function. And obviously, they have to be duals of each other. They have to be Fourier transforms of each other. So it's quite natural to expect to find that we'll get a Gabor function here. But it's slightly different Gabor function. The reason it's slightly different, you notice that it's going to be centralized, the Gaussian part of it is going to be centralized around xi, around a particular frequency. So the Gaussian now is around frequency. And this complex exponential is at a particular s, sorry, a particular u, which corresponds to our time. And this is because doing a time shift in a time domain corresponds to multiplying by a complex exponential in the frequency domain. Duality again. You also notice that we have a factor b here. It's a fraction b, divide by b here. And again, we should expect that, because if we make our function, our Gabor function, our Gaussian, tighter in the time domain, we'll stretch it out in the frequency domain. So that, again, should be something that we expect. We can explicitly calculate the variances of these two, and we can show explicitly that we attain the bound for this. It might be worth knowing these two things, but I'm not going to derive them again in this particular lecture. So here's a picture of a Gabor function. Who is surprised by what this looks like? I certainly hope you're not surprised at this point. You can see the envelope, that's the sort of the maximum amplitudes follow this Gaussian form in both time domain and the frequency domain. And you can also see it's a complex exponential, so I plotted the real and imaginary parts separately, and you can see they're just sinusoids, sine and cosine sort of functions. We have a real and imaginary part. The one I've chosen here in particular, you can see that in the Fourier domain, the real part is significant. The complex, the imaginary part, is almost negligible. This is It's just a Gaussian window multiplied by this complex exponential. The other thing, remember, we squeeze in one domain, we stretch out in the other domain. So you can see, if I squeeze one, I stretch out the other one. And this is a general thing. This is not just for Gabor functions. This is for any function that we like. Okay. So let's think about the short-time Fourier transform. And for effect, what I'm going to do with my short-time Fourier transform is I'm going to use a Gaussian window. Okay. I'm going to tell you why I use a Gaussian window in a second. The colors here in this picture are irrelevant. The colors are just simply to make it easier to tell the different bits apart. So what I'm trying to plot here is the basis functions that we use in the short-time Fourier transform. They're not really basis functions because there's redundancy. Think of them like atoms, the atoms that we're going to use to describe our signal. We're going to describe our signal in terms of products of these, or linear combinations, I should say, of these functions. So if we just did a Fourier transform, our basis functions or our atoms, they would be sines and cosine functions. But here we want to localize them in time. So what we've done is we've multiplied them by a little Gaussian window on each of these rectangles. So each of these rectangles in time represents some block of data. And I've used a Gaussian window and done a Fourier transform. So if I did a Gaussian window, just a rectangular window, and I did a Fourier transform, each of my basis functions would be a little sine function on this little region here. But I'm going to use a Gaussian window, not a rectangular window. And I end up with basis functions that look something like this. They're approximations of Gabor functions. This is why I've chosen a Gaussian window. So if they were actually Gaussians, then they would be Gabor functions. But remember, a Gaussian has infinite support. Here I've truncated it at the edges. It doesn't have a big effect. I mean, there's not much power outside of this region. But it doesn't mean that you can't quite achieve that uncertainty bound. But for this Gaussian window, we're going to get very close to that uncertainty bound. So this Gaussian windowed Fourier transform, or the short-time Fourier transform with this Gaussian window, is going to get us very close to that uncertainty bound because we're using Gabor functions as our atoms, our basis functions here. So this is a picture to try and give you a sort of idea of what these things look like. One of the interesting things here is they don't all look the same. The Gaussian window always looks the same for all of these, but you look at the function. This function here oscillates sort of 3 times, whereas this one oscillates 10 times. They're not really the same. This is a different Gabor function from this one. There's not a simple relationship between the two. They're quite different functions in a lot of ways. It would be kind of interesting to see if we can do this with Gabor functions that look the same, but they're kind of scaled versions of each other. Perhaps we take this guy, and when we want to get a high frequency thing, instead of having a lot of oscillations with this Gaussian window, we take that Gabor function and we squeeze it in time so that the oscillations are faster and the function has a tighter sort of representation. We could do something like that, I think. This is one of the ways people came across the idea of wavelets. And one of the nice things about wavelets, one of the things I think is cool about wavelets is they were invented, I don't know, a dozen times by different people independently, at least 3 or 4 times independently. And some of the cleverer people in the wavelet research area, one of their big contributions was to realize that this work that this guy over here had been doing in seismology was actually the same thing that this guy over here in image processing was doing, and to give it this name wavelets and say it's all the same thing. So this is one of the ways wavelets were invented, because people would sort of look at this sort of basis functions and say, well, you know, we've got a few problems here, why don't we try changing this to a basis where these guys look the same as these, but perhaps compressed. So this is again just reiterating the same things that I've been saying. We want to do this in a way that changes resolution as we change frequency. So this is what wavelets do. Um, Let's forget about Gabor functions for a second. Let's start with a function. It could be a Gabor function, it could be something else. We're going to call it a mother wavelet. And we're going to call it psi. And we're going to put a few little requirements on our function psi. We're going to say it has to be in L2. Remember, this means its L2 norm is finite. This just means that we're going to choose a function which is reasonably well behaved. We don't want functions that are all freaky and strange. Okay. Maybe later on we'll deal with functions like that, but let's keep it simple to start with. We're going to normalize it, so we're just going to say that its norm has to be equal to 1. This isn't really a limitation. You could take any function you like and you just scale it such that its norm is equal to 1. That's just the scaling. It's so that we have a unique definition. It's not really confining our notion of what a wavelet could be. And we're going to insist that when we integrate over that function, we get 0. Again, this is not really a restriction. This is simply saying we're going to shift it up and down such that half of it's below the axis and half of it's above the axis. So these two things don't really limit the range of possible functions we could have. They simply allow us to choose a unique function which has these particular properties. There's still a lot of functions that satisfy this. In fact, there's an infinite number of functions which satisfy these properties. So we have choices here. So now once we have our mother wavelet function, I haven't told you how to choose a mother wavelet function, and in fact, there's 100 different mother wavelet functions that people use. There's at least a dozen that are commonly used. And I'll tell you some of them in a minute. There's a lot of different possibilities for mother wavelets. Then what we do is we're going to construct a set of atomic functions, a set of atoms. You know, this is our analog of basis functions. We're going to construct these by some operations on our mother wavelet. And the two operations we use are a time shift. We know what a time shift is, a translation. Just shifting the function backwards and forwards in time. That's easy. The other one is what we call a dilation. Dilation is a word that we typically use for what happens when you get you walk into a dark room and your pupil expands. This is what we typically mean by dilation. Here, dilation is used to mean something being stretched, basically. And we're not just going to stretch it, we're going to also allow the possibility that we shrink it up as well. So we can stretch and we can shrink our function, or we can shift it in time. So you can imagine what happens with the Gabor functions. You know, the Gabor functions, obviously they can shift in time, that's one of the things we design them to allow. Also we can stretch and we can tighten them up, and we can do this by changing the frequency and changing the width of this Gaussian window. So this is something we can do in general. So this sort of atomic representation, we talked about this when we talked about this generalized Fourier transform. This atomic, this idea of atoms sort of underlies many of these transforms that we have considered. You know, particularly the Fourier transform, the atoms are just our complex exponentials. Cosine transform, they're cosine functions and so on. So imagine that you have some set of atoms, they're in L2, we've normalized them, then our transform is going to typically look something like this. We get some transform at a coordinate gamma, and we do it just by taking the inner product. Remember, inner product is a very general operation, but typically we're just going to, in this course at least, look at L2 inner products. We take the inner product of our function with the appropriate atom, and that gives us our transform, F gamma. So the classic example would be something like the short-time Fourier transform. The Fourier transform is too easy because the atoms are just our complex exponentials. We know how to do that. The short-time Fourier transform, the atoms look like, say, Gabor functions, where we have some complex exponential multiplied by a window function. In the case of the Gabor functions, the window function is a Gaussian. In the case of some other general window, this could be any window function that we like, as long as it's been appropriately normalized so that this property holds. So these are our atoms for the short-time Fourier transform. We had a look at a picture of them. This is what this picture shows you. These are my atoms for a short-time Fourier transform. So we have some set of these functions. And you notice that there's some parameter set, these gammas. So that set of gammas, it could be a set of integers, or it could be a, you know, a real number s. It could be a frequency, something like that. It could be some pair of numbers, psi and u, something like that. So we have to deal with all these possibilities here. So how do we define our wavelet transform? Well, we're just going to use atoms, which are dilations and translations of the mother wavelet. So these are going to be my atoms here. These are my dilations and translations of the mother wavelet. I have this little scale factor here. That just makes life easier when I'm doing the inverse transform. So these are my this is my mother wavelet, this is my translation, and this is my scale, this is my dilation of it. I have a bunch of these. I'm going to index them by U and S. These are my wavelet functions. My inner product with F just gives me my transform. So this is the inner product here. This is the L2 inner product in particular. And there's a couple of different ways I could denote my wavelet transform. So one way would be to simply say wavelet transform of F. But that's kind of a big curly symbol and doesn't really help. Typically we'd use something like this, which is the wavelet transform of F at coordinate U and S. And you notice immediately, I hope, that now we're transforming into two-dimensional space. Again, as in the short-time Fourier transform, we don't just transform into a frequency space. We transform into a time-frequency plane. So it's a two-dimensional space. How do we do reconstruction? Well, assuming that we had some set of these wavelets which were orthogonal, then we could use the generalized Fourier transform stuff I showed you earlier. When we have a set of orthogonal functions that form a basis, we can invert using a sum of all of our coefficients, our inner products, times by the functions themselves. And that will reconstruct to give us our function. So assuming we have an orthogonal or preferably an orthonormal system of wavelets, then it's easy enough for us to reconstruct our original function. So we have a transform and we have an inverse transform. But I haven't told you yet how to choose an orthogonal set of these wavelets. So that's not a trivial thing to do right. There are many, many possible mother wavelets. We're going to look at a few of these as we go along. Classic examples are things like the Ha, Dorbashi's, Mexican hat, Gabor. You can guess what the Gabor wavelets are going to be, I hope. They're just going to be Gabor functions. Dorbashi's one is interesting. It looks kind of weird. We'll look at that a bit as we go along. Here's the Mexican hat one for your edification. It's just the second derivative of a Gaussian function. It looks kind of ugly. You don't have to remember this. I'm not going to ask you in the exam to reproduce this function. But I want you to get an idea of what we get out of these things. This is interesting, this one, because it has infinite support, clearly as the Gaussian does. But quite often what people will end up doing with one of these wavelets is truncating it at some point. And this is what it looks like. This will be the wavelet, the mother wavelet that we'd use, and this is its Fourier transform in this particular case. So you can see this mother wavelet. Let's go back and have a look at one of the pictures I had back here. It looks a lot like this thing down here, doesn't it? And you find that what a lot of these wavelets are actually doing is trying to get some function which has sort of similar properties to a function which looks like this, say this red curve here. The one that we have here looks, I mean, actually it's a little bit different. It's not exactly the same, but it has some sort of similar properties. It has this sort of sharp bit down here and so on. Actually, if you think of this function in terms of, think of it like a filter. One of the things that you notice about this filter. Well, let's have a look at it in the frequency domain. It's filtering out some of these low frequencies, but primarily it's giving us high frequencies. Primarily it's getting these two parts of the spectrum. Typically these wavelets viewed as filters, we talk about filters in a lecture or two, but typically they end up being high pass filters. Sometimes band pass, depending on what way we look at them. So here's an example wavelet transform. I've taken this signal up here, it's a transient signal you can see, and I've done a wavelet transform. On this axis I have the log of this value S. Why take the log? Well, we'll talk about that a bit more later when we talk about scale. And here we have time again. And you can see some correspondence between these two guys. You can see a lot of interesting things going on in this plane now. We can see some sort of rippling thing going along at this particular scale, this sort of frequency. This is some sort of analog of frequency here. We get down here, you can see something much more blurry going on. It's hard to interpret this picture. It's not a trivial thing to work out what's going on here. It's sort of a pretty picture to show, but I can't tell you exactly what to do with this picture at this point. We need to do a lot of things before we get to the point where wavelets are going to be really, really useful to us for analysis or for understanding what's going on here. So we'll get to that. We have a couple of things we want to cover before we get there. Firstly, how do I choose an orthogonal set of wavelets? Because, you know, sometimes I want to plot the whole picture, but mostly I want to have an orthogonal set of wavelets. I want to have a set that gives me a basis. It means I have no redundancy, I have a very efficient representation for my data, and I can reconstruct perfectly via the simple formula that I showed you earlier. The way we do this, typically, is to choose points on the dyadic grid. This is the dyadic grid. I have increasing frequency, this is the time frequency domain. Increasing frequency here, increasing time along here, and you see what happens. At high frequency, I have a very high sampling rate. At low frequencies, I have a lower sampling rate. And it's dyadic because it goes in powers of two. So as I go down here, the size of this interval doubles each time, and the size of this interval doubles each time. Why is this a good thing? Well, remember your Nyquist rule. If we had a high frequency, we'd have to sample at a high rate. If we have low frequencies, we have to sample at a low rate. This is just the relationship between these two scales is just based on simple sort of Nyquist-like intuition. Why do we double? Well, that's a numerical thing. This dyadic grid turns out to be extremely efficiently calculable. So the reason it's this particular shape out of all of the possible sorts of shapes where we have high sampling at one and low sampling at another, the reason it's this particular shape is because of computational efficiency, and we'll get to that in a lecture or so. So what happens with this when we partition the time space up? We get a picture that looks something like this. Low frequencies, we have very poor time localization. There's a big wide time bin, but good frequency localization. Frequency localization is really good. At high frequencies, we have very poor frequency location, but very fine time resolution. This is exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted to break up this domain a bit more flexibly so that we saw high resolution where we needed high resolution. But you notice the area of each of these boxes is the same. We can't make the area of each of these boxes any smaller. And our basis functions look something like this, or our atoms. And the thing that you'll notice is, this is the sort of basic shape here, say this purple function here. It's again a Gabor function or a Gabor-like function because it's truncated. You notice that if I go up here, it's the same function, it's just been compressed. And it's been stretched this way a bit as well. There's a scale factor applied to it, but mostly it's been compressed in time. Here, it's just been stretched out. So these functions, unlike the Gabor atoms that I showed you earlier with the short-time Fourier transform, these atoms, the functions all look the same. They've just been stretched or compressed. Continuous wavelet transforms. So this is our transform. We have our wavelet functions, which we remember are all going to be dilated, translated versions of a mother wavelet. So this is our mother wavelet function. This is the translation part of it, and this is the dilation part of it. And we can do our reconstruction down here by taking our wavelet coefficients, these numbers, and taking a linear combination of the basis functions, the wavelet functions themselves. And this will give us back our original function, assuming we have some orthonormal set of those original functions. So we have a bunch of different possible mother wavelets. I'll talk a bit more about some of these as we go along. Mexican hat wave that I showed you in the last lecture, so we're not going to spend a great deal of time on that. And the point of this is we need to construct some sort of orthonormal basis, and we want to do it in a way which matches up with our aim. And our aim was this mapping this time frequency domain in such a way that we get appropriate resolution for appropriate frequencies. And so this is what the dyadic grid does, sampling on this dyadic grid. Breaks the wavelet, the frequency time domain up into rectangles. Each of these rectangles, as we know, has to satisfy the uncertainty bound, has to have a minimum area, but we can have long, thin rectangles up here and short, fat rectangles down here. Okay, so we end up cutting it up into a set of basis functions that might look like this. And remember, because they're wavelets now, all of the basis functions basically look the same, but they look like different scaled versions of each other. And we can define the dyadic grid by simply taking a set of points S, which are 2 to the power of j, and u, which are 2 to the power of jn, and you can see how that matches up with these points here. S is going to be going in the other direction, though. So we have a sampling which is spread out by 2 to the power of j. J is kind of coming down the board. So j is inversely, or S is sort of inversely related to frequency. Typically, we talk about S as being a sort of notion of scale. So when we have lower frequencies, smaller frequencies, they have a longer scale because the waves are long and big. So their scale is bigger. This value of J we often call the octave. And this is by direct analogy to music, musical notes that I talked about early on in the course. When we think about an octave is powers of two. You go up an octave in terms of, you know, you go from one note A up an octave to the next note A, the frequency doubles, and then doubles again. And that's what's happening here. When you go from one scale to another, the frequency is doubling, or the scale in this case is doubling. The frequency is inversely related to that scale. So we get a set of basis functions that look like this, which are just, again, they're scaled or dilated, shifted, translated versions of these mother wavelets, but now we have these particular values of the shift and the dilation. And we typically denote this basis function by psi nj. By direct analogy to things like the power spectrum or the spectrogram, we have what we call a scalogram, and this is simply the power in each of these wavelet coefficients. It's WF at U and S, and we square that, square the absolute value of it. One thing to notice about this is this wavelet transform, often enough, these wavelets will be real functions. Remember, the Fourier transform, part of the issue we have is the basis functions are complex. So with wavelets, we get a choice. We can have wavelet basis functions which are complex, or we can have real ones. And a lot of the wavelet bases that people use are real bases. And this makes life a bit easier because most of the functions that we want to transform are also real functions. So we end up with a real set of real numbers. So your wavelet coefficients are quite often real numbers. This simplifies the arithmetic. You don't have to do complex arithmetic. On the other hand, there are often good reasons for using complex arithmetic, using a complex basis. And the Fourier transform is a good example of that. The Fourier transform allows you to encode phase and frequency in the same picture. So there are good reasons sometimes for us to include complex wavelets. I'm not going to spend any time in this course talking about complex wavelets, at least not this year. Okay. The other trick is that the wavelet transform, we can apply the wavelet transform either in the time domain or in the frequency domain. So we can do our wavelet transform here where we do an integral across our function f with psi, or we can do it in the frequency domain, where we do it with big F, the Fourier transform of F, and big Xi, which is the Fourier transform of our wavelet function. Why is this? Well, this comes down to the Poincaré identity. Remember, the Poincaré identity told us what we could do with integrals like this, and we could do them either in the time domain or in the frequency domain. So this is just derived directly from Poincaré. Notice that because to get psi us, we do scaling and translation. In the frequency domain, we have some mother wavelet in the frequency domain, and we also get our wavelets in the frequency domain by scaling, but notice that instead of the one on S, we have a product with S, and that's because of this property, the scaling property of the Fourier transform. We also have this is the time shift. Doing a time shift in the time domain corresponds to multiplying by a complex exponential in the frequency domain. Again, this is the modulation property of the Fourier transform. So it's easy enough to work out what our wavelet coefficients look like in the frequency domain, our wavelet functions look like in the frequency domain. So one of the things that's obviously interesting to us, given the amount of time I spend talking about uncertainty, is what the time frequency resolutions of these functions are actually going to be, because we're trying to make these rectangles as small as possible in the time frequency domain, so we should at least know how big they are. It's pretty easy to derive. This is just our wavelet transform equations written up again here. So without loss of generality, I'm going to take a wavelet function which is centered at zero. Likewise, this is my mother wavelet, my actual wavelet basis are going to be centered around U. So this is the central time, this is the localization of that wavelet in time. So when we calculate the variance around that, we use 2 minus U squared times the absolute value of these wavelet functions. I can easily do a time shift here. And when I do a time shift, I get rid of this U, but I also change this U to a zero. So I can look at the basis function. I don't need to look at all of the basis functions, because think about this, they're just time-shifted representations of each other. If they're a time shift, then the variance isn't going to change. The variance around the middle of it isn't going to change at all. So I can get to this point pretty easily. And then I simply do a change of variables. What I realize is that I have a scale function in here, so I want to do a change of variables where I change t to t on s. And when I do that, I end up with an s squared factor out the front of the integral, but now I have a mother wavelet in here. This s squared comes over here, and this thing, I'm just going to call this the variance of the wavelet itself. So this sigma t squared is related to the mother wavelet. So it depends what mother wavelet I choose. Clearly, if I choose a mother wavelet which is very dispersed, I will get a bigger variance in time. The trade-off, though, might be that I get better frequency resolving power. It's more compact in the frequency domain. Likewise, as I showed you, I can work out the Fourier transform of a wavelet function. It looks like this, and I can go through a few steps. Firstly, with the Fourier transform of this thing, I can work out the center frequency of this wavelet, the average frequency of it. And I just do that by looking at this guy. This thing doesn't change frequency. This is multiplying by a complex exponential. It's a change in phase. It's a rotation in the complex domain. So I don't have to worry about this term. This is just the scale factor. I don't have to worry about this. So I look at this guy. And I notice it's got an SR in it. That is just a dilation of the original function, and therefore the frequency is going to be the frequency of the original mother wavelet, this eta psi divided by s. I have a multiplication by s here, so that means that the center frequency is divided by s. Okay, so this is why we relate s to frequency. S is, we call it the scale, but it's related to frequency inversely. It's the center frequency of this wavelet is going to be 1 over S, or proportional to 1 over S. There's this extra factor which depends on which mother wavelet I'm choosing. So you can see that this scale, this parameter S that I'm putting into my wavelet, is inversely related to frequency. And this is just a derivation of how you would work out the center frequency for any particular mother wavelet function. Now, work out the spread. To work out the spread, we need to look at an integral that looks something like this. I've already done a bit of simplification. I've got 0 to infinity instead of minus infinity to infinity and so on. The important thing is that this guy looks very much like the function that you would use to work out it's very much like the function you would use to work out the center or the variance of the mother wavelet. It's just related because we have this scaling going on here. So when we look at the variance of this guy, it's just been scaled by a factor of S squared. So when we think about our mother, the spread of this wavelet atom in the time frequency domain, we get something that's going to be S sigma t wide, and it's going to be S omega divided by S wide in frequency. You multiply these two things together and you get sigma omega times sigma t. So you can see that these rectangles, the sort of distribution of this wavelet basis functions in the time frequency domain, is going to have a fixed area. It's going to be this sigma t, sigma omega, regardless of which wavelet basis function we look at. But the thing about the wavelet basis functions, I want to emphasize this again, is even though the area of these rectangles is fixed, as we change S, the sort of relationship between the height and the width of these rectangles changes. Okay. So that's enough about wavelets for a minute. What I want to talk about now is a slightly different topic, multi-resolution approximation. And I'll relate this back to wavelets. And why am I going off on a different track? Well, as I said in the last lecture, one of the interesting things about wavelets is the fact that they've been independently derived on three or four or five or six or possibly more occasions from completely different perspectives. So one of the perspectives we've talked about so far is this idea of the uncertainty bound and how you chop up this frequency space. Another way of tackling this type of problem is by thinking about approximations, and in particular multi-resolution approximations. So we're still going to hang on to this S being the scale, and we're going to look at the idea of approximating a function at a particular scale. One of the things that we commonly do with data analysis, for instance, the financial data that we looked at earlier in the year, you start with data perhaps that was collected every second, the prices of a stock every second, or maybe every minute of the day. But you end up with data that's very hard for a human to actually really understand, unless they're looking at, say, the last hour. If you're looking at the last hour, looking at every minute makes sense. You've got 60 data points. You can at least hope that you might see patterns in that. But if you look at the last year at that 1 minute data, then it's quite hard to see what's going on. You have so many data points. So what people tend to do is things like exponentially weighted moving averages, as we saw with the data I downloaded from Yahoo. And what they're trying to do there is some sort of smoothing of the data. They're doing an approximation of the data. A typical one people might do is just look at an average. So you might say, look at the average over the last hour. Instead of looking at every 1 minute, you look at the average stock price over the last hour. Or maybe you look at the maximum stock price over the last hour. Or maybe you look at the minimum stock price over the last hour. Or maybe you look at some other smoothed version of the stock price. The goal here is to look at an approximation of that stock price. Now, if I'm looking at a week's data, then looking at 1 hour time scales, maybe that makes a lot of sense for me in terms of approximation. But it doesn't make much sense if I start looking at 10 years data. Again, I'll run into this problem, there's too much data, it would be hard for me to perceive, hard for me to look at it and see the patterns in that data. So what would I do then? Well, typically what you might do then is approximate up to a different scale. You might approximate up to daily data and look at the daily prices of those stocks. For instance, you know, if you look at any of the news reports, for instance, you know, Channel 2 on the news report, they quite often have a little summary of some financial fact for the week, for the day. And what they'll do is they'll put up some graph. And they might put up, say, the stock prices or the CPI or one of these various indices, and they'll put it up and there'll be the prices for the last year or the CPI for the last year, and they'll show you 10 data points. In reality, that's some sort of approximation of some underlying curve. And the scale at which they show that data is chosen to make the graph look pretty. In a lot of cases when they put it on TV, it's just to make it look pretty. But even when analysts look at this data, they have to look at the data at an appropriate resolution for the task that they're interested in. So one of the things that naturally arises out of this is the idea of a multi-resolution analysis, where you don't just restrict your view to one particular resolution. You look at a range of resolutions of the data. So you might not discard this fine resolution data, this highly sampled data every second or every minute. You keep it, but you also form an approximation at 1 minute, or an approximation at 1 hour, approximation at 1 day, so that you have all of this data in there in some form. So this concept of multi-resolution analysis can be formalized. And when we formalize things, one of the typical things we do is we look at powers of two. Instead of looking at timescales like 1 minute, 1 hour, and so on, let's look at powers of two. So we'll start with some fine grid, some sampling at timescale where the sampling interval is TS, and then we'll look at 2 times TS, and then we'll look at 4 times TS, and 8 times TS, and 16 times TS, and so on. We'll have a multi-resolution analysis with this sort of powers of two structure in it. So that's what we're going to head towards. We need a few concepts to be a little bit more refined before we get there. So firstly, we have to decide what we mean by an approximation. Okay, I mean, we all have, I think, an intuitive notion of what an approximation is. What I want to give you is a formal definition of an approximation. So imagine that you have some space of functions, some subspace, and we're going to call it V. And typically we'll take a subspace or a vector space, something like L2. Remember, this is the set of squared integrable functions. Functions who, when we integrate them, the result gives us a finite value. And we're going to project it into some subspace. What do we mean by that? Well, what we're saying is that we have this set of functions, they can be very complicated. L2 is a very complicated space. You can have all sorts of weird functions in it. What we're going to try and do is say our approximations have to be less complicated. That's what an approximation is, really. It's a less complicated view of the same signal. You know, less data points in it, or less information makes it easier for us to absorb that picture because it's simplified. Somehow it's smoothed in some way. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, well, the approximation functions, the functions we're going to use, it has to be a smaller space. There's no point in it being a bigger space. And it may as well be a subspace of this thing, because we don't want to have approximations which couldn't be in this space in the first place. Why would that? That wouldn't make sense. Why would you approximate a function with something that's more complicated than it? Okay, so we'll keep our subspace, the one where our approximations lie, as being smaller than this guy. It's going to be some subspace. And one natural way of taking a function in some big space and getting it into that smaller space is what we call projection. How does projection work? Well, think of a projection as finding the function f hat that's in our subspace, such that we minimize the distance between f and f hat. So this norm here, this could be the L2 norm, it could be some other norm. I'm going to think of it as a distance. Remember, this is one of the nice properties of a norm, is once you have a norm, you can define a distance like this. So this makes a lot of sense. I want the best, I mean, I could choose any approximation I like, but really what I want to do is choose the best approximation for my function. And the way I define best is I say that the best approximation is going to be the function which is closest to my original function, the approximation which is closest. So the other nice thing about this definition is that as long as I have an orthonormal basis for V, then I can construct this projection simply like this. And you notice that this projection looks an awful lot like an inverse generalized Fourier transform. In fact, it is. You can think of these inner products as generalized Fourier transform coefficients, and then this construction of F hat is the reverse operation. But the difference here, the reason this is not a generalized Fourier transform, it looks a lot like it, the reason it's not is because we're projecting into a space which is smaller than our original space. So clearly we can't invert back afterwards, because some of these functions are going to be projected to the same point in this space, and then after that we've lost information, we can't project back, we can't reverse the operation. So this is not a true inverse function. F hat is not equal to F in some circumstances, some cases. Obviously, if we start, one of the nice things about this though is if we start with a function in V and we project it into V, we get back the original function. So if we have a function already in our approximation space, nothing changes. That's desirable, and that means the distance will be minimized. The distance, in fact, will be zero between the two. And given the properties of the norm, that's the only case when you get a zero distance here. So this is what we mean by approximation. This is a formal definition of the approximation process. I'm sure you could come up with other definitions of approximation, but this is a very common and a very powerful way of defining what we mean by approximation. So here's a little example that you should all be familiar with. This is the case of a vector space which is just the space of vectors. And in this case I have 3D Euclidean space R3. So we have 3D vectors, vectors with three components, and what I want to do is approximate this vector by a vector in the two-dimensional plane, the XY plane here. How do I do that? Well, the way of doing it is you project your vector into that plane. It's simple to do that because, well, I've written down how you do it here. All you have to do is take the inner product of your vector, V, with the basis vectors of this XY plane, and I've chosen the simplest basis for all I know, it's just the basis vectors 1, 0, 0 and 0, 1, 0. So I've taken the inner product in the case of the vector Euclidean space, the standard inner product is simply a dot product, V dot 1, 0, 0. And then I multiply that, this is a scalar, this V dot 1, 0, 0, this is a scalar, so do a scalar multiple of that with the basis vector itself. So if I take V times V1 times 1, 0, 0, I'm going to get V1, 0, 0, multiply by this thing, I get V1 out of this, multiply it by this, and I get V1, 0, 0. Here I'll get 0, V2, 0, add the two together and I get V1, V2, 0. So the projection of a vector V1, V2, V3 into the XY plane is just V1, V2, 0. Exactly what you would expect. So let's think about what the norm is here that we're minimizing. Not surprisingly, it's the standard Euclidean norm. It's simply the square root of the sum of the squares of the components of the vectors. The standard Euclidean norm, so this distance here is the minimum distance for any vector V hat which lies in this XY plane. So this concept of projection is something you should have come across in first year. And this is a case of approximating a vector by another vector. The other thing I just want to point out while we're here is there's something left over after this. there's this vector, but there's an extra bit here. So if I recorded this bit here, this sort of how much I had to go up here, then I could reconstruct my original vector. And the other thing to notice is if I record this vector here, you notice that this vector is at right angles to this one. This is one of the properties that you typically get with projection. The difference here, this extra bit, is going to be orthogonal to the approximation. So I can retain this bit, and this orthogonal part I can use to reconstruct the original vector. That's important for us a bit later on. So let's think about approximation into an example of approximation. This is a more realistic example. This is one where we have a function, and it's some sort of continuous smooth function in this particular case. It doesn't have to be, though. And what I've shown you down here is my basis functions. And I'm just choosing for my basis functions here a set of rectangular pulses. The first one is this phi 1. And you can see it's a rectangular pulse here. The second one is a rectangular pulse here. The third one is a rectangular pulse here. And so on and so forth. Now, you can immediately see, I hope, that these are going to be orthonormal functions. Because they don't overlap at all. So if I multiply this one by this one and then integrate, I'm going to get zero. If I multiply this one by itself, I'm just going to get a rectangular pulse, and as long as I make sure the area in each of these pulses is 1, the integral will be 1, and therefore I will get a orthonormal basis. So this is a nice orthonormal basis. What happens when I try and do approximation? Well, remember, how we do approximation is we do an inner product with one of these vectors, one of these functions, and then we multiply that by the function itself. So what happens if I take this red curve and I do an inner product with this guy here? Anyone want to guess? Simply what it's going to do is the inner product is going to be the integral of this function multiplied by this function. Integrate. When I multiply this function by this function, what do I get? All I'm going to get is a truncated version of this. I'm going to get these values, but the function is going to be zero outside of there. So it's going to be a truncated version of that function. The other thing that's going to happen is that I'm going to multiply this by this, I get a truncated version, then I'm going to integrate that. When I integrate that, essentially what I get is an average of this function over that interval. So the number I get, the coefficient I'm going to get, when I take the inner product of this function with my function that I want to approximate, is going to be the average over this interval. Likewise with this basis function, I'll get an average over this interval over here. So I take that average and I multiply it by this function. Take this function, multiply it by an average, and I'm going to get a function which looks like a rectangle, but its height is going to be the average here. So what I get when I do this, when I add them all together, is a function that looks like this, this green curve. You see, it's this thing here multiplied by the average of that red curve over this interval. Likewise for this interval, it's the average of the red curve over this interval. This is not an exact picture, this is a cartoon. This is just something I drew up to make it look nice. These are not exact averages here, they're just meant to look approximately right. But you get the idea, I hope. Each of these intervals, what we see is an average over this guy. So taking these rectangular pulses as a basis, what we get is a piecewise constant function as our approximation. Say that again. This is what we call piecewise constant. It's made out of constant pieces. Each of these bits is a constant. It's discontinuous, so it's kind of ugly in some sense, but it's not a bad approximation. This is a very typical approximation. A lot of people use an approximation like this. not a particularly good one, it's not particularly bad, depends on what you're trying to do. Lots of people use this sort of approximation, at least implicitly in what they do. So what we want to do is not just study, this is an approximation at one particular scale, and I would call the scale of this, say I would call it this distance. That's a sort of natural thing to call the scale here. What we want to do is construct a multi-resolution analysis. We don't want just an analysis at one particular scale, we want a multi-resolution analysis. So I have a bunch of properties here that we use to define a multi-resolution approximation. A multi-resolution, people interchange the terms multi-resolution analysis and multi-resolution approximation. I'm going to try and say approximation whenever I can remember. So what properties do we want to have when we talk about a multi-resolution approximation? Firstly, J is going to be a thing I'm going to call the octave. That's what I call down here, octave. And it's going to correspond to a scale being 2 to the J. So J is going to be this idea of an octave. Remember, this is the notion that we're going to go up in powers of 2 when we do our multi-scale resolution. We could go up some different way, but it makes sense for this to be a logarithmic scaling. It makes sense to exponentiate, go up in something to the power of J. And 2 is a natural one for most of us who have any sort of computer science background, because we're mostly used to binary logic and so on. So 2 comes up again and again in this sort of context. It also leads to very efficient algorithms. We'll see that later on. So J is going to be my notion of octave. So what if I take Vj plus 1? This is going to be at a higher octave. In some sense, it's going to be a coarser approximation, a cruder approximation to my original function. If it's cruder, then it should be a subset of Vj. What that means is that if I take some function in Vj plus 1, then it also has to be in Vj, which means that if I take a function in Vj plus 1 and I try and approximate it in Vj, I don't have to do any work. There's no approximation to be done, because that function is also in Vj, and therefore its approximation is just the function itself. So this is a very natural sort of criteria. As my approximations get coarser and coarser, I expect them to do it in a reasonable way where they become subsets of the finer level approximation. You can think of this going back the other way. If I have a coarse approximation and I approximate it at a finer level, clearly nothing should change. I shouldn't have to worry about anything changing. Then I have these two criteria here. And these criteria are very much linked to this power of 2 nature of the octaves. Firstly, I'm going to say that if I have a function which is in Vj, so that means that it's an approximation at level j, then if I translate it by 2 to the j, it's still going to be a valid approximation. Okay, let's go back and have a look at this picture. If I take these functions, and this green curve, and I translate it by exactly this distance, I translate it like that, then it's still an approximation in the sense that it's a linear combination of these basis functions. So it's still a valid approximation, although it's not an approximation anymore for the red curve. It still lies in this set of possible approximations. Likewise, so this is the other thing. So this tells us what happens within one scale as we translate a function. The second thing happens when we try and relate between different scales or different octaves. When I go from octave J to octave J plus 1, what I have to do is dilate my function. So when I go to a cruder space, a coarser space, what I do is I stretch my function out, and it will still be in that approximation space. So this is linking the notion of approximation up to the notion of scale. Here's a picture. give you an idea of what I mean. This would be my V0 scale. When I go to V1, I stretch the functions out and I get a coarser approximation. And you can see that this function, if I stretch it out, it would now be a linear combination of basis vectors like this, so it would fit into that approximation scale. Then we have some limits. As we make our approximation coarser and coarser and coarser, eventually we just get to the trivial approximation, which is zero. You assume your function is just zero. Obviously that's a bad approximation because it doesn't tell you anything at all about the function. But this is just the limit as we get coarser and coarser and coarser. In the other direction, as we get finer and finer and finer, we want our subspaces to eventually get back to L2. So if we have J go to minus infinity, we want to be able to represent any function in L2 without any distortion. Perfect fidelity. And then finally we want these basis functions to form a respaces. And I have a little definition of a respaces at the end in the appendix of these notes. You don't have to know it. The idea simply here is that we want these functions that build up our subspaces to form a basis. So here's my example. You go coarser this way or a finer approximation this way. And you can see as the scale gets smaller, you get a better approximation for your function. So you can see how this relates in some sense to the sampling that we talked about way back in lecture 3 as well. The piecewise constant approximation is it's okay in some senses, but it's kind of crude, and also it has these jagged edges which are undesirable in many cases. So there are a lot of different techniques people use for approximating functions. For instance, Shannon approximation uses sinc functions. The reason it uses sinc functions for its approximation is it's aiming to have a compact support in the frequency domain. And so if you have, say, a rectangular pulse in the frequency domain and you do the inverse Fourier transform, you get a sinc function in the time domain, and that's why we end up with Shannon functions here. Incidentally, Shannon functions are what we implicitly do when we run something like a digital to analog converter. A digital analog converter is implicitly trying to take some sort of sample points and interpolate between them. And essentially the way you do that uses this type of interpolation. You can think of approximation as another way of doing interpolation as well, I should say. The other form of approximation people often use is spline-based approximation, where you use cubic polynomials or quartic polynomials as your basis function. Okay, so we start with some basis functions for our multi-resolution approximation, and we can derive a set of scaling functions, things we call scaling functions. And these look, in their construction, just like wavelets. So we're starting to get towards wavelets now. The reason for this is we start with some mother scaling function, calling phi, and we construct our bases for the various different octaves of approximation by dilations and translations of the mother scaling function. This is exactly the same process that we use to construct our wavelet basis from the mother wavelet. Given that we have a base set of basis functions like this, at some particular octave J, we can get an approximation F hat J, so this is my approximation at scale or octave J, and we do it in the way that I suggested earlier, simply by this projection. In the standard case where we have an inner product that looks like an integral like this, we can take our scaling functions, we can write them in terms of our mother scaling function here, and we can notice that this thing just looks like a time-reverse version of phi convolved with f. So this thing looks like a convolution, and that's what I've written down here. It's a convolution of f with our scaling function at scale j. Time reversal is being indicated here by this bar on the top of the function, and this is at point n. So this is nice. This relates the projection, the approximation that we've been doing, back to the filtering that we did earlier in the course. Remember, a filter is just a convolution. So we can think of the construction of this approximation as a filtering process. We need to do filtering by these guys, but notice that I get all of these filters, all of these guys, via this convolution. So this thing is just a convolution then multiplied by these basis functions. So I can construct my coefficients by filtering the function f. To take account of that, I'm going to call these guys ajn. The ajn's are just my filtered version of the function using the scaling function. This is going to be an approximation. It's a smoothing of the data. When we smooth data, typically we're thinking in terms of a low-pass filter. Low-pass filters have this property that they tend to smooth data. So typically we want to filter the scaling function to look like a low-pass filter. When we think of a larger scale, that means we've done more smoothing. If we've done more smoothing, that means the low-pass filter has a lower cutoff. The other thing that we can think about is the relationship between approximations at different octaves. So we could take our approximation at octave j and we project it into vj plus 1 and we get an approximation at octave j plus 1. And we do that again by this standard projection operation. Clearly we lose something when we do this. We're getting a coarser approximation, and when we get our coarser approximation, you're losing some detail. So it would be nice to have some way of keeping that, perhaps in another space. And the space we're going to keep it in is going to be called WJ plus 1. So these WJ plus 1 are the bits that we lost in the approximation. And we want to keep enough information in there such that if we had VJ plus 1 and WJ plus 1, we could approximate back to get our FJ. I should rewrite this. This should be VJ, I think. Now, I'm going to explain this to you in dreadful detail over the next couple of hours. But it's natural to associate this WJ plus 1 with the wavelet. So we do our approximation with this scaling function, but we get this WJ, we get this space of the details, the bits that we left out, we call them the details, we get that using the wavelets. Here's a kind of picture. We take our approximation at some fine approximation, we project it into a coarser space and we get a coarser approximation, and we keep the orthogonal part of that. We keep it in this space, WJ plus 1. And by analogy to R3, that example I showed you in Euclidean space, we preserve this orthogonality property between the two, WJ plus 1 and VJ plus 1. Okay. So there are some properties that are imposed by this relationship between the spaces. Firstly, if we're going to construct VJ out of WJ plus 1 and VJ plus 1, clearly WJ plus 1 has to be a subset of VJ. If this is a subset of VJ, this means that any function in here, say psi j plus 1, which is in WJ plus 1, is also going to be in VJ. That means that we can write, what it means for this function to be in VJ means that we can write it as a linear combination of the basis functions there. like this. In particular, I'm looking at a function psi 0 j plus 1. And I've written it as a linear combination. We know what these coefficients are going to be. They're going to be the inner products. Because we would get this by doing a projection. But remember, the approximation is going to be perfect. There's no approximation going on here because we're projecting something inside the space into itself. So this is really just like a transform. So now we have a relationship between functions that sit in this space, wj plus 1, and the functions, the basis functions of vj. Now, if I say that these are going to be my basis functions for wj plus 1, that's okay. This is true of any function in wj plus 1. So it must be true of the basis functions. So I'm only going to look at the basis functions for wj plus 1. Those basis functions here must be written in terms of this linear combination of the basis functions for vj. Also, we have this orthogonality property. We want to retain this orthogonality. We want wj plus 1 to be the orthogonal complement of vj plus 1 in vj. What does that mean? Well, that means that the basis functions for vj plus 1 and the basis functions for wj plus 1 must be orthogonal. That means their inner product is going to be 0. We can't get a case where it's 1 because clearly these two functions can't be the same because they're in separate spaces. These two spaces, I should add, wj plus 1 and vj plus 1, they have to be disjoint. Clearly. Not much point in having them if they're not disjoint. Okay. So, given that I have these properties, let's extrapolate what I can find out from them. Well, this is the first property. This is this relationship between the basis functions of wj plus 1 and vj. Let's consider the case where j is equal to 0. So I'm just going to put j equals 0 in here, and I'm going to, in particular, look at the case where, well, I'm going to look at the 0 basis function here. So psi 0, 1, t is going to be a sum a1 of m times my basis functions for v0. Remember, if these are going to be wavelet basis functions, they're going to be related to a mother wavelet. And the relationship to the mother wavelet just means that it's a dilation. So this is a dilation of my mother wavelet. Over here, these guys are just translations of each other. These are the scaling functions. Remember, at some particular scale, 0, I can get them from the mother wavelet just by translation. There's no dilation here because the scale or the octave is 0. So I just have to do a translation in here. Then what I'm doing here is a change of variable. I'm doing a rescaling by root 2, and I'm doing a change of variable t on 2 goes to t, and I do the same thing here. And you can see that I end up with a simple relationship like this. My mother wavelet function, if these are going to be wavelets, these basis functions for wj plus 1, if they're going to be wavelets, then this relationship has to hold. There has to be a relationship between the mother wavelet and the mother scaling function. And it has to be in terms of this linear combination, some values of an. But the values of an, I still haven't told you what the values of an, I mean there's a hell of a lot of things I could put in there for an. There are going to be some restrictions though. For instance, take the second property, the fact that these two functions must be orthogonal. The basis functions in W0 and V0 must be orthogonal. What that means is the integral over the product of the two must be 0. So if I substitute this guy in for psi t, I just put it in here, I take the linear combination, the sum of these a's out the front because the integral is a linear operator, and I get an integral like this. And this relationship limits the possible values of ak that you could have. For instance, let's consider what we call the Haar wavelet basis. So I don't think I told you about the Haar wavelets before. The Haar wavelets are really easy. The Haar wavelets Well, I want to tell you what the Ha wavelets are. The Ha scaling function is a rectangular pulse. It's this piecewise constant thing that I showed you before. Let's go back. These are the Ha scaling functions. These guys here are the Ha scaling functions. And the green curve is the result of your Ha approximation. So they're rectangular pulses. So I'm going to substitute the scaling function into here. Now if I put the scaling function in here, all it does is restrict the range of this integral from n to n plus 1. And I get the scaling function here. But you notice that this thing, because again it's this rectangular pulse, it's only going to have positive values, or non-zero values I should say, in the interval n, n plus 1. For k is equal to 2n, or 2n plus 1. So instead of having a sum over all possible k here, I only have to look at the values k equals 2n, or 2n plus 1, and in both of those cases, this integral will give me 1. And so, I get this relationship, a2n plus a2n plus 1 equals 0. So this clearly restricts the possible values of a that I could have in my Ha wavelets, given the scaling function. Typically, we look for functions with minimal support that, you know, the minimum number of these values should be positive. The minimum of this that would be simply take a0 equals 1 and a1 equals minus 1, and I take all of the other values of a to be 0. So to do that, I get the function of minimal support which satisfies this equation. Clearly it does. a0 plus a1, fit it into there and I get 0. All of the other cases are going to have 0, so they'll all be 0. So this works. What happens when I put these guys in here? Well, we simply substitute them into this formula here, and we can derive the model wavelet in terms of the scaling function. So let me draw you a picture. This is the scaling function. It's just a rectangular pulse. This is the model scaling function, a rectangular pulse. To get the wavelet function, what I need to do is do a dilation of this guy. And in fact, the dilation I'm going to do is going to be a squeezing. So I'm going to take this and I'm going to squeeze it here. And that gives me part of it. The other part, I take this squeeze thing, I do a shift of it, and then a minus, because the a value is negative. Let's just have a look at the picture again, the numbers. See, this is the, this 2 gives us the squeeze of it. This 2t minus 1 gives us a squeeze and then a shift, and we have a minus here. So this is the squeezed first bit. This is the squeezed second bit with a translation and a minus sign. So this is this first, this is a0, and this is the a1 term. And you can see how we get the wavelet. So once we have the scaling function, we can get a wavelet function. So these two things are really coupled together. So this is some examples of the Ha wavelet. And what I'm showing you here is the blue curve is the scaling function, and the red dashed curve is the wavelet function over on this left graph. And on the right hand graph I have the spectral representation, frequency domain representation. And you can see what I've been saying is kind of true, that the scaling function is a low pass filter. It's not a particularly good low-pass filter. It's a rectangular pulse. So what's this Fourier transform going to look like? Come on, speak up. A sinc. We have a rectangular pulse. Its Fourier transform should look like a sinc function. We only see part of the sinc function here, because I'm only showing you, you know, 0 to 0.5 of this frequency spectrum. And this is a short filter here. So you can see it's not a particularly good low-pass filter. It's got a wide transition region. When we look at the filter for the wavelet, an interesting thing happens. We see a mirror image of this guy. Why is that? Well, actually it turns out that these two together form what we call a conjugate mirror pair. of filters. And these sort of filters have some very nice properties which we'll talk about in the next lecture. As we increase the octave, this scaling function gets wider as you would expect. It's coarser, the coarser level approximation, so the scaling function gets wider, as does the wavelet function, although they retain their same basic shape, their same basic relationship. You also notice it gets a bit flatter, a bit shorter, and this will happen as we keep going along here. The other thing that happens is now the low pass filter has a lower cutoff, you notice. And our wavelet filter becomes a band pass filter, centered around the sort of middle. And as we successively go up scales, the low pass filter has its cutoff move lower and lower. And this is exactly what you should expect. The lower that cutoff, the more approximation, the more smoothing is going on. There we get down to here. So what's sort of essentially happening is these wavelets are chopping up the spectrum in these bands. The scaling function is just this low pass. So if you think about, say, the various bits of this, the W's and the V's up to scale J, the low scale approximation at octave 2 is chopping off this bit of the power spectrum, this low frequency part. The wavelets is chopping this higher frequency part of the spectrum into a series of bands. And the interesting thing about these bands is they're logarithmically sized. So this is half of the spectrum. And then if you just consider what's left, this is half of the spectrum. And if you consider what's left, this is half of the spectrum. So at each point, you take half of the remaining spectrum. Obviously, the Ha wavelet filters are nothing like this sort of precise separation of the bands. But as I said, there are many different wavelets. Maybe we can have a different sort of wavelet functions or scaling functions which has better band pass properties. And in fact, there are particular cases of this. Okay. Multi-resolution analysis and wavelets. Perhaps I should show you this picture first. This is what's going on here. We start with some sort of fine approximation, perhaps an actual function at some level, and we successively get coarser and coarser approximations, and each time we spin off a little wavelet bit. So one way of representing this is we do our approximation. This is the standard approximation I showed you with these coefficients. At the same time, we do this f dot. This is not a derivative, this is the details. And we're going to call the detail coefficients d. A for approximation, d for detail. So this is how we form our approximation and our detail from the next scale up. And we can go backwards by doing this orthogonal sum. So when we want to go back up this tree, we take these two guys and we add them together doing this orthogonal sum, and we can get back to Vj plus 1. The next finer level of approximation. Thinking about this, these are going to be my basis functions at some particular octave, then Wj must be the span of these basis functions. Just one way of constructing the space out of a set of basis functions. But what we could do is extend this thing going all the way down to infinity. When we go down to j goes to positive infinity, this space goes to zero, it becomes trivial. So if we go back up this way, we can reconstruct Vj just out of all of these wavelet components. And that's what this is really saying here. We can get Vj by doing this orthogonal sum over all of these W's from I equals J to infinity. Another way of thinking about that is we have our wavelets sampled on these sort of grids. This low frequencies is down where we have this coarse approximation scale. So we have this S being big. 2 to the J tells you how far apart these sample points are going to be in the dyadic grid. So this dyadic grid is related back to this multi-resolution approximation. The dyadic grid comes from this multi-resolution approximation view of things, at least in one sense. So you can see now how this multi-resolution approximation idea leads you back into the space of wavelets. This is the reconstruction equation. This is just saying if I want to get my approximation at octave J, I can do it by the sum of these two components, the approximation and the detail, and this is writing out the approximation and the detail in full. So again, these are things that I've said all the way through this thing. The scaling function doesn't come out of nowhere. We have this low frequency notion of approximation. Again, this slide is really just formalizing some of the things I've been saying as we go along. We get these scaling functions, from a mother wavelet by using translations the same way we translations and dilations the same way we do with wavelets from a mother wavelet. So one of the things you can think of when you start thinking about this fact here, that Vj is this orthogonal sum of the Wi's, is the fact that this scaling function brings in information from all of these scales greater than or equal to 1, this mother scaling function. And so we can think of it as some kind of aggregation of the wavelets above this scale, and we can come up with some more relationships between, say, the scaling function, the power of the scaling function, and the wavelet function over a whole range of scales from 1 to infinity. Again, I'm not going to go into any detail here. I just want to give you another perspective on what's going on. So this is really what we call the discrete wavelet transform now. Some things to think about in the discrete wavelet transform. This is not like the discrete Fourier transform. The continuous wavelet transform is a transform from a continuous space to a continuous space. The continuous Fourier transform is a transform from a continuous space to a continuous space. The discrete Fourier transform goes from a discrete time space to discrete frequencies. The discrete wavelet transform, on the other hand, goes from a continuous space, these are continuous functions, to a discrete space. So it goes from a continuous space to a space where we have these discrete indexes for the approximation and the details. We end up with something that looks like this. So it's a discrete transform in the sense that it transforms to a discrete space, but it doesn't work with discrete data. We still have some work to go before we can do transforms of discrete data. And that's what the next lecture is about. Secondly, we don't always have to do this transform all the way down through this tree. We don't have to go and get all of these wavelets all the way down to infinity. Typically what we will do is take this tree, this decomposition, down to some particular approximation. So if we want to do that and we want to have a transform that we can invert, we have to keep this thing, the approximation down here, and all of these details up here. And with all of those things together, we can go back through this tree and we can get back up to the top, wherever that top may be. If the top is just Vj, then that's okay, we have a finite number of things here. If the top is going to be L2, we have to go all the way back up to negative infinity. So that's what we're doing here. What I've done is fixed some scale J0, and I'm keeping the wavelet coefficients and the wavelet bits of that from J0 to infinity. And obviously I'm doing all of the values of n that I possibly, that's all the translations of these wavelet functions. So these are the wavelet parts of it.